Good morning. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, Portland's only community-owned and democratically run radio station. Welcome to the Old Mo Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Joe Clement is our engineer. The Old Mo is dedicated to bringing you different perspectives on history, culture, politics, and current events than that of the corporate-owned conventional news media. Today on our program, Bill Resnick will be talking with Willie Groeschel, who is on the state executive board of the National Association of Letter Carriers. They'll be talking about the problems of the Postal Service, the campaign to destroy it, and the disaster that will result, as well as what needs to be done to save it. Following that, I'll be reading an article by Alyssa Rokert entitled Capitalism and Climate Change. Larry Bolden, our fiction critic, is here to talk about a book by Portland author Tom Spanbauer entitled Now is the Hour. Spanbauer is perhaps better known for his 1991 novel, The Man Who Fell in Love with the Moon. Concluding our program today, our engineer Joel Clement teams up with Brad Duncan, a radical musicologist, to talk about and listen to some of the music of Fred Ho. Fred Ho was a Chinese-American jazz baritone saxophonist, composer, band leader, playwright, writer, and Marxist social activist. He died this past April at the age of 57. We'll be listening to some of his music throughout the program. This coming Friday is, of course, the 4th of July, originally a day to celebrate the signing of the Declaration of Independence, which marked the beginning of the American Revolutionary War. Sadly, over the years, this day has become a jingoist celebration of American militarism. Before bringing on Bill Resnick, talking with Willie Groeschel of the National Association of Letter Carriers, I'd like to mark the coming 4th of July celebration of war with an anti-war song by Phil Oakes called I Ain't Marchin' Anymore.
Willie Groeschel, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Willie Groeschel is on the state executive board of the National Association of Letter Carriers. He's an activist in Local 82 here in Portland and in the campaign to save our post office. Willie Groeschel, there is a campaign to destroy the U.S. Postal Service, basically dismember it, sell its profitable parts, and most parts are profitable, as you'll be discussing. That would be a disaster for its workers and for the people of this country whose mail, packages, magazines, all delivered information would be controlled by private firms. Willie, before getting to the great value of the post office to the American people, it's not appreciated very well, but before getting to the great value of the Postal Service and how we can save the Postal Service, let's go through the claims of the people who would break it up and privatize.
Okay. Like the fact that you've been hearing for years now the Postal Service is losing billions of dollars every year. And that's simply not true. The last 2 years, 2013 and 2014, the Postal Service has been having profits on its operating costs. In fact, in 2014, operating side of the costs of the Postal Service has already turned a profit of over $1 billion. Over these past 2 years, 100% of all of the financial losses the Postal Service has experienced are due to the pre-funding requirement that exists to the Postal Service and nobody else. In 2006, the Postal Reform Act that was passed had a bitter pill placed in it that forces the Postal Service to be the only organization in the entire country, public or private, that is required to 100% pre-fund all of its retiree health care benefits 75 years into the future. So the post office, starting in 2007, has had to pay over $5.5 billion a year into this fund to pay for health care benefits for people that not only do not work for the Postal Service, but haven't even been born yet.
Yes, there's no other company, no other agency.
Nobody
who
else.
In fact, you're building up this huge amount of money, which is being spent by the federal government. Essentially, it was a tax on people. Republicans didn't want to pass a tax. So, in fact, they just decided to take money from the post office, which would then have to raise its rates. A great deal of the rate rise in the post office is, in fact, to be able to pay that $5 billion a year. And they want to now take more, actually. There's now bills in Congress. Let's make the post office our little piggy bank. We can take more money now for the highway tax.
For the highway operations tax. Yeah, that's the most recent bill to come out of the Republican House, is to eliminate Saturday delivery in the Postal Service, which they claim will save billions of dollars, which can then be shifted to pay for the deficit in the highway funding legislation that's going to come up this summer. Basically, to take money from the Postal Service to fund other government agencies. Yeah. Never mind that the studies the post offices have done by independent firms have shown that the elimination of Saturday delivery along with the other cuts the post office is doing would actually cause the Postal Service to lose more money than they would save by eliminating the day of delivery. Yeah.
The corporations, lots of people are saying we have to fix our roads. They're now becoming a bottleneck all over the country, and we need better transportation system to sell our goods. The Republicans don't want to tax anybody, of course. There are no tax. So they decided just to steal money from the Postal Authority. Let's talk about the bright future for the post office. People think the internet hurt newspapers, it's hurt radio stations, it's changed the way people exchange information, and they believe first-class mail is also down in the post office, and that's, in fact, therefore really hurting the post office. We have to think of a new postal system, that the old one didn't work.
Initially, and even now, first-class letters have decreased and are still decreasing, and that traditionally was the main income revenue source for the United States Postal Service. But the public now does so much shopping through the internet, and the Postal Service is the primary company that delivers all of those parcels. The amount of parcel delivery the Postal Service is doing now is the highest it has ever been in the entire history of the United States Postal Service, and it is extremely profitable, so much so that the Postal Service is expanding to doing parcel delivery 7 days a week. Even here in Portland, by the end of June, there will be parts of Portland that will receive parcel delivery from the Postal Service on Sundays as well.
You know, the privatizers have another charge against the post office, which is actually absurd, which is this post office is inefficient. It's an absurd claim when you look at the post office in sort of international comparative perspective. The U.S. post office is a miracle compared to almost every other country in the world.
Yeah, the United States Postal Service services a larger area, more people, more delivery points than any other organization in the entire world, does so with tremendous efficiency, reliability, and is also the premier in affordability. It is the most efficient and affordable postal service in the entire world.
And it's the fastest. I mean, by efficient.
Oh yeah, by efficient.
It takes longer in Germany for a letter to go 50 miles than in the U.S. 500 miles.
Even private firms do a lot of their business through us. Every single year, the United States Postal Service delivers millions of parcels for UPS, Federal Express, DHL, and other private companies because we're the only company that has a universal door delivery network where we will deliver to anybody, anywhere within the United States of America, including our territories.
If the post office were privatized, it's very unlikely that universal delivery would remain, because there are lots of rural areas in the United States where there are few people per square mile. There are parts of Alaska where delivering a letter can cost, I suppose, $50, $100, $500. You've got to put it on a small plane. You're taking 10 of them to some outpost somewhere. And in rural South Dakota and North Dakota, very long trips in trucks to reach a relatively few people. What the post office does is spread the cost of the service over the entire population so that you have a universal delivery service and people have a guarantee of being able to send a letter to out-of-the-way places, to their friends anywhere, and for the same amount of money as any other letter. Yeah. It's a wonderful service, but the private firms wouldn't do that at all.
The private firm's bottom line is going to always be profit. And so they're going to do what they can to maximize their profit. And part of that will be that there might be portions of this country that don't get delivery. Or if they do, it will cost them a premium to receive it. Or they might only get that delivery maybe once every month or two when there's enough volume to make it worth their while.
Or they would demand subsidies from the state or the city or the national government. You want to go into us to deliver in Alaska, you pay the price. I'm sure that...
Yeah, and those kind of gimmicks, unfortunately, have already taken place in some other countries in the world with their postal services, where there's some nations where you have to pay a monthly or yearly fee to receive delivery.
You know, part of U.S. Postal Service efficiency is quite... brutal is the wrong word. The very sort of rigorous campaign, I mean, the campaign to work people harder and faster, to equip them with GPSs. Tell us a story.
Well, the job as a letter carrier today is very different from how it was even just 10 or 15 years ago. The work used to be that you'd be in the office casing up your mail, getting the route ready for 3 to 4 hours in the morning, and then you'd be out in the street for about 4 hours making the deliveries. Now, most delivery routes, you're in the office for an hour, maybe an hour and a half, and you're out on the street making deliveries for about 6.5 to 7 hours a day. So the routes are significantly longer as far as the amount of territory they cover and the amount of physical work that a letter carrier's body goes through is significantly higher than it was, especially with the increase in parcels. We're carrying larger, bulkier loads than we ever used to before. It's the nature of where the Postal Service is going, but it's still there for all the public, and we're very happy to do it. And it's extremely efficient given the complexities of the workload. I'm very proud of what my coworkers are able to accomplish on a daily basis, being able to serve our communities. In fact, every single day, there's not a day that goes by that I don't deliver medication from the Veterans Hospital to at least one veteran on my route every single day. And we are one of the primary sources for making sure that the veterans in this country have access to the medications they need. And I would hate to see that system get damaged in any way.
This is Cable Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Willie Groeschel, who's a activist in the National Association of Letter Carriers, on the executive board, very active, and also in the Save the Post Office campaign. Willie, let's talk about the motives of the politicians, basically, but also the corporate sector that's pushing them for transforming the post office in many ways, selling off parts of it, speeding up the work, as well as contracting out many of the services from reasonably well-paid unionized postal workers to very low-wage people doing exactly the same job but at lower wages. Mm-hmm. That's, of course, then they can extract even more money from the post office.
The underlying motives is the privatization of the United States Postal Service. That way private firms can come in and claim the profitable portions of the Postal Service so that they can continue to grow their market share, grow their profit margins, increase their stock values. But the expense of the workers, the communities, the service, all of that would suffer, because when you have something designed as a public service, designed to be there serving everybody, as opposed to something as a private company designed to make a profit, the mentality and the drive behind the work that you do gets completely changed. And there are forces out there, many of them, within the government, within the Postal Service even, that would love nothing more than to see the profitable portions of the Postal Service go into private hands.
You know, I think some of it has to do with the fact that there are a number of strong unions in the Postal Service.
Yeah, the National Association of Letter Carriers, the American Postal Workers Union, the Mail Handlers Union, the Rural Letter Carriers Unions. All four of those unions combined nationwide, you're looking at hundreds of thousands of employees that have living wage jobs in every corner of this country, in every corner of this beautiful nation of ours, and they would much rather see those jobs be part-time, temporary, no-benefit jobs to ensure maximum profit at the expense of not only the workforce, but the community.
The market is king. In the market, you can get people to do to deliver letters, I suppose, although they might forget the routes, they might stash the mail in the sewers or whatever.
Yeah.
But you could probably hire people to do your job for a whole lot. There'd be people out there who would be willing to do it.
Yeah. And when you start going down that road, the biggest flag that jumps up to me is the security of the mail. For me and my fellow coworkers that are unionized and do this job and are proud of the work that we do, we don't compromise on the security and safety of the mail because it's not worth it. Our jobs and being a good part of the community and being able to have a living wage makes us do the best job we can and stay on the straight and narrow.
There's one final thing. The post office happens to be what conservatives call an entitlement. People have a right to get information. Mm-hmm. They have a right to send information to other people at a reasonable price all over the country.
Yep.
It's an important right, the right to get information and to send it, it seems to me. And I think it rankles these conservatives that, in fact, that these entitlements, they call them, give people sort of this sense of security.
Those very entitlements are written into the American Constitution. The United States Postal Service is a part of the American Constitution. And the beauty of it is that anybody, no matter where you are in this country, has equal access to be able to send and receive private communications to anyone. A first-class letter has got 100% privacy on it. Nobody besides the recipient gets to open that letter and know what's inside of it. In fact, in this day and age, if you have something that's vital to communicate to another human being, in my opinion, the safest and most secure way to ensure that it gets to them and nobody else gets access to it is by sending them a first-class letter through the United States Postal Service, because that has protections and privacy that no other form of communication in this country has.
And there are no hackers who can get into it either.
No, you don't have to worry about cyber hackers.
Willie, it's very easy to see how the post office could both turn a decent profit, deliver mail for less than any other postal service in the world, and remain this part of a democratic society in that it transmits information at low cost from anywhere and by anybody.
Yeah.
One of the things, one of them is just to eliminate that prepay. I know you've been going to the Congress, the Republicans. The Democrats have not been terribly good on the post office, but the Republicans are really predatory in trying to destroy it. But there is legislation that has some support just to eliminate that prepay thing, which would mean the post office could even lower its rates quite a bit.
Yeah, potentially. Yeah. To me, if we keep the rates where they are right now, eliminate that pre-funding, the type of profits coming in, you could transform the way the Postal Service does its business. We could become an energy-independent organization. We could be the spear point for developing modern oil-free fleet of vehicles in this nation. Manufacturing-wise, if we had to develop a couple hundred thousand vehicles that relied on non-fossil fuel means to deliver mail, whatever manufacturer got that would be able to really grow with it.
There's also other proposals to increase postal revenue, like the postal bank, that actually has a chance of passing. There's so many people who have no banking services because the banks aren't interested in poor people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are countries in the world with postal banks precisely for those people who need a really low-cost sort of method of paying bills, cashing checks. There's all these predatory companies, of course, who want to serve poor people and pay, and demand huge amounts of money for cashing a check. The postal bank could be, in fact, a real successful for basic banking services for poor people who are not served by...
Yeah, postal banking is a wonderful idea. It's been done before. They got rid of it because it was so effective. But the post office used to do banking services.
I think it was 67. It was eliminated.
Yeah, it was in the 60s that they eliminated it. But it was an effective service, especially in smaller rural communities. I'm thankful that Senator Elizabeth Warren is picking up that ball and running with it, and is really doing a good job of trying to develop a postal banking system that would serve the public and also help the Postal Service to grow.
Finally, right now, Staples is developing a substitute postal service with very low-wage labor. Staples hiring mm-hmm. employees to do post office work, at least the in-office work.
Yeah, what's going on right now is the most public face of the privatization efforts of the United States Postal Service. This is already being done as a trial. The actual post offices are publicly pushing the business out of the doors of the Postal Service over to these Staples kiosks. And the security is just not the same, because the Postal Services are being done in the Staples store at the same place as their UPS shipping or their FedEx shipping is where they do the copying center. You don't have the same level of security and accountability with whatever you send there that you do when you walk into the Postal Service. We take the security and the sanctity of the mail very seriously. And I guarantee you that the workers at Staples, you know, bless their hearts, they don't have the same scrutiny and they don't have the same wages and benefits that we do. They don't have the same reason to care about the mail that we do as postal workers.
Yeah. U.S. postal workers have good reason for, in fact, protecting the mail and the postal service, because, in fact, people are decently paid. It's one of the last pretty good working class jobs where you can raise a family.
Yeah, you know? it's a living wage job where in most places in this country you can actually have a family and be able to get by without having to scrape.
Thanks, of course, to the union struggles.
The postal strike of 1970 is the primary reason for that.
How could people get active in the campaign to save the post office from privatization, particularly now the Staples campaign?
Well, the Staples campaign is really starting to take off. It's great because now the national AFL-CIO has joined on in a national boycott of Staples stores as long as this program is going forward. Recently, we've gotten other organizations and unions to back and sign on with the boycott of Staples. So one of the things that we're doing, as long as this is happening, we are publicly pushing for people to go to other Office Depot stores, other places for your supplies and whatnot, because what's happening between the management of Staples and the management of the Postal Service is nothing more than an attempt to privatize the Postal Service. We're encouraging people to not go to Staples for the time being.
Yeah, and watch for demonstrations in front of Staples and join them.
Actions that will be taking place on a regular basis in some of the Staples center Staples around the Portland area, and there's many actions that have been happening around the country at other Staples stores. Okay. Yeah.
Willie Groeschel, thanks a lot for talking to us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Bill.
The next piece is entitled Free New Africa Boogaloo. The civil rights movement during the 1950s and 1960s asserted that the proper response to unjust laws is to break them. The Black Power, Black Liberation movement asserted that black people are an oppressed nation with the rights to self-determination and to land and territory. Such demands, the demands of Native peoples, of the Kanaka Maoli, so-called Native Hawaiians, of the new Africans in Black Belt South, the Chicanos, and many other peoples for land, territory, self-determination is the beginning in the process of dismantling the American empire. That dismantling requires the deconstruction of what we understand to be the 50 United States, of which two of them granted statehood in 1959, one of which is at least 1,000 miles from the lower 48, and the other at least 3,000 miles at the equatorial zone from the west coast of the United States. Free New Africa, Boogaloo.
You are listening to the Omo Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM. That was our first Fred Ho composition entitled Free New Africa Boogaloo. Don't forget our program will conclude today with Joe Clement discussing the music of Fred Ho, jazz musician and Marxist activist, with Brad Duncan, our musicologist. Is capitalism by its very nature unable to deal with climate change? Capitalism cannot survive without ever-expanding growth. The environment cannot withstand such continual growth. This is unarguably the most dire catch-22 the world has ever faced. Today I'm going to read an article entitled Capitalism and Climate Change, The Growth Problem, by Alyssa Rohrig. Capitalism dominates the globe, Rohrig begins, has become so enmeshed into the cultural narrative that it seems almost axiomatic. Private owners of capital control the means of production, the goal, build profits. The best part about it is that if everyone pursues self-interest, the market will grow and society will benefit. The invisible hand helps the market to self-regulate, creating socially desirable results. Simple? No. When it comes to dealing with issues such as poverty, the income gap, unemployment, economic crises, human rights, war, imperialism, and the externalization of costs on society and the environment, the visible hand that Adam Smith once imagined is not invisible. It is non-existent. We are currently experiencing, without a doubt, the greatest crisis to face humankind. Indications of climate change are being seen around the globe. Accelerated melting of the Arctic ice, sea ice, rapidly receding glaciers, rising sea levels, warming oceans, and ocean acidification, more frequent and longer lasting droughts, stronger and more frequent storms, higher temperatures than ever recorded, and a rapid extinction of species are a direct result of a warming climate. There's a scientific consensus that the climate is rapidly changing and that these rapid changes are due to anthropogenic causes. The science is clear. The human caused emissions of great amounts of greenhouse gases, primarily carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide, are causing global environmental damage. Many argue that the market and techno-based approaches are the way to combat climate change. They push for carbon taxing and trading, geoengineering, and renewable energy without considering the fact that the system itself is incompatible with sustainability. By its very nature, capitalism seeks to only to grow and accumulate an idea that is diametrically opposed to sustainable existence. Ecological economist Herman Daly perhaps best emphasized the issue of unlimited economic growth acting within a limited environment. He called the idea of sustainable growth a bad oxymoron that is simply impossible. Impossibility statements are the very foundation of science. It is impossible to travel faster than the speed of light, create or destroy matter energy, build a perpetual motion machine, etc. By respecting impossibility theorems, we avoid wasting resources on projects that are bound to fail. Therefore, economists should be very interested in impossibility theorems, especially the one to be demonstrated here, namely that it is impossible for the world economy to grow its way out of poverty and environmental degradation. In other words, sustainable growth is impossible. Earth's ecosystem is finite, yet our culture has developed a system whereby economic stability is gained only through unlimited growth. Within the capitalist market system, growth is essential, and the larger the growth, the healthier the economy. When growth slows or worse, stops entirely, the system is in crisis. Earth's carrying capacity and yet unfettered growth of the world's population and greater resource consumption have continued. The World Watch Institute estimated that as the world consumed resources at the same rate per person as the average person in the United States, the Earth could only support 1.4 billion people. A world population of 6.2 billion, a number that we've already far exceeded, can only support an average per capita income at about $5,100 per year. In the U.S., the average income per year is about $28,000. Yet reducing our consumptive habits is antithetical to the capitalist enterprise, which functions only if the economy is growing. We have created a world system where economic health is directly opposed to environmental health. Capitalism necessitates ever-increasing resource use, while the natural capacities of the environment require a severe cutback in consumption. John Stuart Mill recognized this problem early on. He saw that capitalism focused on unlimited growth within a limited environment would logically lead to immense environmental destruction. Yet instead of dismissing the system altogether, Mill argued for a stationary state, or a state where economic growth ceases. Quoting Mill, "If the earth must lose that great portion of its pleasantness, which it owes to things that the unlimited increase of wealth and population would extirpate from it, for the mere purpose of enabling it to support a larger but not a better or happier population, I sincerely hope, for the sake of posterity, that we will be content to be stationary long before necessity compels them to it." End quote. Yet a stationary state would mean certain disaster for a capitalist economy. Growth is simply essential for its survival. Spurred on by competition, capitalism seeks constantly to reinvest surplus into more capital, a system of self-expansion seeking only greater accumulation. The concept of stationary capitalism is an oxymoron. Not only does capitalism need to expand its resource production and consumption, it also must seek out new markets in which to establish itself. Population growth is basic to capitalism, which is always seeking to grow the labor force and increase production of the good, and thus capital. Growth in population means demands increase for new housing, furniture, appliance, schools, roads, cars, agriculture, and so forth, creating a healthier capitalist economy at the great expense of the environment and all species that inhabit it. The more people there are to purchase a car and fill it with gasoline, the more money that floods the market. Directly opposed to the constant need for growth are Earth's natural systems and carrying capacity. Scientists at the Stockholm Resilience Center analyzed several of Earth's systems and calculated the planetary boundaries for each that are vital to maintaining an environment livable for humans. Many of these boundaries have already been exceeded. In the case of carbon dioxide, the pre-industrial value was 280 parts per million, concentrated in the atmosphere. The planetary boundary is estimated at 350 parts per million. Currently, the Earth is at 390 parts per million. The measurements for biodiversity loss read similarly dire. Some of the systems measured for the planetary boundary have not yet been surpassed, yet the data is hardly comforting. The phosphorus cycle, the quantity flowing into the oceans, had a pre-industrial value of 1 million tons. The boundary is estimated at 11 million tons, and the current status is 8.5 to 9.5 million tons. Ocean acidification, freshwater use, and land use are likewise teetering at the precipice of disaster. And yet in the face of this potential catastrophe, capitalism would only have us grow more. Land use for agriculture and development are encouraged in order to grow the economy and increase capital. Freshwater is being used at alarming rates for industrial production and industrial farming. Rivers, lakes, and oceans are being polluted with plastics, heavy metals, runoff from farmlands using pesticides and other chemicals. And as temperatures increase from the burning of fossil fuels, the temperature of the planet rises, further increasing ocean acidification and permafrost melt. This healthy economy is leading to a very unhealthy planet. That was an article entitled Capitalism and Climate Change, The Problem of Growth, by Elisa Rorick, a journalist, activist, and dissenter who maintains the blog The Black Cat Revolution. And you are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM. Now in our studio is the Old Mole fiction critic, Larry Bolden, to discuss a 2006 book by Portland author Tom Spanbauer entitled Now is the Hour.
Good morning. I want to talk to you today about a book I should have reviewed several years ago when I first heard of it. The book is Now is the Hour, written by a local author, Tom Spanbauer. Walking with one of my oldest friends and walking partners, I was introduced to Tom and immediately asked him if the name of his novel had anything to do with the song of the same name. It was the very first song I ever learned by heart from listening to the radio. As you will see if you read the book, it has a lot to do with the song of the same name. Although this is a work of fiction, it reads very much like memoir, and I would be very surprised if it were not closely autobiographical. The lead character, Rigby John Klausener, like Spanbauer himself, grew up in Pocatello, Idaho. His mother, a staunch Catholic who holds a tight rein on Rigby John, and his farmer father is a stern and tough man whom Rigby describes as an ornery bastard. Quote, cold, irritable, impatient, one ornery bastard, close quote. Spanbauer dedicates the book to his mother, and the deep love Rigby John has for his mother is apparent from the first page. And that he almost always disappoints her causes him to suffer greatly. A younger brother, Russell, is born with severe birth defects and lives for only a short time. When he dies, a light goes out of his mother's eyes. Quote, Russell came home screaming, and he screamed for 100 days, and no one could sleep, and then he died. Mom was never the same. The music stopped, and she locked herself inside her room with Dad, and me and Sis were outside her room, and her eyes were never the same. I couldn't find her anywhere in them, couldn't find me. She was so far away. Close quote. The highlights of this young life are the times when his mother, sister, and he dress up in fancy clothes and jewelry from a large trunk in the attic. As Rigby John tells the reader over and over, when all three were dressed up, we were scintillatingly gorgeous. But of course, they couldn't let his father find out about the dress-up game. I happen to have also read it, when the reader first meets Rigby John, he's 17 and hitchhiking to San Francisco, hopelessly alienated from his family because, quote, my family and the sex shame guilt thing. Sex and my family just don't mix, like Mormons and Coca-Cola, close quote. Bad enough that his mother has caught him literally with his pants down, masturbating, leading to a frenzy of confession and Hail Marys. His love affair with his own penis is enough to condemn him in his mother's eyes, but that he is also gay is so far over the top that he has no choice but to run away. I happen to have also read a short time ago Wallace Stegner's autobiographical coming-of-age novel, Big Rock Candy Mountain. Both books are wonderfully honest accounts of growing up, and I would have to say that I think Spanbauer's is the better book, partly because it is such a subtle and insightful exploration of homosexuality and of prejudice against Native American people. I also preferred it to the Stegner book because I think Spanbauer is so much more understanding of his parents. Even his stern, ornery father, whose hatred Even his stern, ornery father, whose hatred of vitriolic rants against his father taint the last sections of an otherwise lucid and interesting story. Spanbauer, on the other hand, seems to understand and forgive his parents, despite the grief they cause him as he struggles to discover himself and his sexuality. Even on the road to San Francisco, intensely sad and having to flee, he is able to at least partially understand their reasons for treating him as they have. Like so many young people who find themselves in tight, repressive communities, with condemnation seeming to come from all sides, often enough leading not only to confusion but self-hatred, Rigby John finds solace in reading, his path into a larger and more open world. Quote, "Mom and Dad wanted me to read only good Catholic stuff. The only good Catholic stuff to read are your Daily Missal and the Bible and the Lives of the Saints. So anything that was good, I had to hide. I had to smuggle Steinbeck and Willa Cather and Hemingway inside my pants. Reading made everything different. I was no longer stuck in a world with my mom and my dad and my sis and Catholics and Mormons on a goddamn farm out on the Tyhee Flats. Before books, my secret places were just places I could hide. Now my places were where I could go to read and find out about people who were like me, of mice and men, my Antonia, Winesburg, Ohio, a movable feast." Close quote. Like Rigby John and Spanbauer, I grew up with a self-righteously religious mother, Mormon in my case. As I came to learn, she knew very little about Mormonism or even Mormon texts. She simply knew that it was the truth and that any who doubted it was lost. Spanbauer's Pocatello was probably even more politically conservative than the Salt Lake I grew up in the 40s. Spanbauer captures the diction and customs of the country people he grew up around. He tells us over and over they are different. Not different, but different. He tells such a good and convincing story, capturing both the humor and the heartache of trying to grow up into one's sexuality, especially when faced with criticism on almost all fronts. The friendships of one girl, as different as he is from those around him, and then of two Hispanic farm workers and later one very colorful gay Native American man, saves him from his isolation and encourages him to find a world not so hostile to his beliefs and his body. I read Spanbauer's wonderful book, The Man Who Fell in Love with the Moon, many years ago and loved it for many of the same reasons that I love Now is the Hour. He's a truly gifted writer and one who helps us to see that it is not bad to be different. I recommend him to you, especially those of you who have found yourself in a strange and foreign and cramped space as you grew up. His liberation is one that we can all learn from. I've been talking about Tom Spandauer's 2006 novel, Now is the Hour. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you, Larry. And this is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. Before bringing on Joe Clement and Brand Duncan to talk about Fred Ho, the man and his music, let's listen to another of his works. This one's entitled The Damned Don't Cry.
Thank you.
Once again, this is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM. That piece was called The Damned Don't Cry, which is part of a larger work called The Black Liberation Suite. Now here's Joe Clement talking with radical musicologist Brad Duncan about the life and career of Fred Ho, noted jazz musician and Marxist activist.
Well, I'm Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I am joined by the knowledgeable Brad Duncan, our radical musicologist. Thanks for coming on, Brad.
Hey, my pleasure. Good to be here.
So as people will have noticed, if they've been listening to the show, we have had a selection of what most people will probably recognize as jazz by Fred Ho. And Brad is here today to offer us some perspective on his music and how he came to making it. I found out about Fred Ho through an article that Brad had written earlier this year for Solidarity, an obituary of sorts, because Fred Ho died of cancer in April. Let's start off with the obvious. Who was Fred Ho?
Well, Fred Ho was a musician and composer and political activist. He was born in the late 1950s and came of age both as a musician and politically in the late 1970s. And his music, although he hated the term jazz, was very much influenced by jazz music, both avant-garde jazz music and Charles Mingus. And then as a political activist, he was a Marxist and very much a revolutionary socialist who really identified with anti-colonial movements happening in the Third World and also very strongly identified with the Black Liberation Movement here. And he was also an Asian American musician who really helped bring in and highlight Asian Americans working in experimental and avant-garde music and led a number of different groups of Asian American artists that pulled from the black radical music tradition that some people call jazz. Like I said, Fred hated the term. But that's a little bit of who Fred Ho was.
So why did he hate the term jazz?
Well, he said that the roots of the term jazz, to describe this kind of African-American music, that it really was kind of a derogatory term. It was pejorative, or it was basically making it sound like it was exclusively the bawdy nightclub music of houses of ill repute, as opposed to one of the great contributions to world culture. He saw the term as kind of an early put-down of this musical tradition with kind of a racist bent to it. And he's not the only one to think that. Yusef Lateef also often criticized the use of the word jazz, especially artists who were making music during the period of decolonization around the world. It wasn't uncommon to hear people whose music obviously was directly from that tradition, but really had a problem with that term specifically.
I noticed that you mentioned Third World Marxism in your article about Fred Ho. What is Third World Marxism, and in what way, outside of his music, was Fred Ho participating in this?
Fred Ho was, as you were saying, a Third World Marxist, or a revolutionary socialist, who believed that the anti-colonial struggles that were happening in Africa and Asia and Latin America, again, continents that in terms of population represent the vast majority of the human race, that those movements were really at the cutting edge in terms of overthrowing imperialism and capitalism. And it was a version of Marxism that really blossomed worldwide in the 60s and 70s, very influenced, in addition to being influenced by all the movements in Africa and in Vietnam, as I said, also very influenced by the Chinese Revolution. Maoist is also a term that's applied to this tendency, although the word isn't always embraced by the activists themselves, but it comes from really that zeitgeist from the anti-colonial period, and it's a version of socialist philosophy that really comes out of that experience. And he was a part of a group, an Asian American Marxist-Leninist group in the 1970s that eventually fused with a Chicano Marxist group and an African-American Marxist group and formed an organization that existed through the 80s called League of Revolutionary Struggle, which was a group that Amiri Baraka also played a significant role in. And so really he was involved in a number of different aspects of the activism, although frankly trying to bring music and culture and performance to the settings in which movement spaces to events and protests, this was so much of his activism. Now, of course, he did have real organizing experience, but in terms of what we might think of as typical bread and butter street campaigns of activists. But again, his work as a musician and as a composer really is also very much part of his political practice as well. I don't really think he totally saw activist work in terms of building different community organizations and political groups like League of Revolutionary Struggle. And his work as a performer and composer, he saw them as totally intertwined, as opposed to kind of different aspects of his life.
And in what way did he bring his activism into his composition, or even like his stated theories about what music is and what it means to make it?
Well, I would say one of the very significant things that he did, he created these great, almost really opera-type pieces, large suites, large compositions with many different moving parts that followed a historical narrative. And often they were kind of involved fantasy, but were political narratives that talked about the history of different liberation struggles and in kind of magical realist way, blurred time and space and kind of wove these different struggles together. I'm thinking of some of his great operas and jazz operas, if he wouldn't mind the term, from the 1990s. So part of it is he would work their historical and political narrative into the pieces. To me, they remind me of Charles Mingus's suites on different themes related to civil rights and the Black Awakening of the 1960s. So that was a big part of it. I mean, those compositions were really about something. You couldn't help but be politically engaged in that way. And then also, I think part of it was of constantly bringing an element of performance and culture to the spaces that are kind of the battlegrounds of our daily political work. I mean, he performed at exhausting and otherwise quite dry, although very necessary, political conferences, and brought a vitality to it that infuses what we try to do as political people. He saw the value of just putting the arts in the movement, even when you don't have a unified theory for it, but putting the arts in the movement. So, again, there's a number of facets of ways that he combines the two, but those are some of the things that first come to mind.
Well, Brad, in bringing this interview to a close, could you speak a little bit about the last part of Fred Ho's life, which was a struggle with cancer?
Fred Ho had cancer for a number of years and was very public in his battle with cancer. And he really approached it, as he did so many things in his life, politically and with an incredible kind of revolutionary vigor. He even wrote a really great book about fighting cancer as a revolutionary and as an artist. And really, that's part of his remarkable legacy, is the unique approach he brought to his writing around his fight with cancer was really remarkable. He was also, up to his dying day, involved with a campaign to free Russell Maroon Schotes, the political prisoner. So he was political right up until the end as well.
I've been talking with Brad Duncan, a radical musicologist, about the revolutionary music and third world Marxist activism of Fred Ho. Brad has written an article about Fred Ho, who died earlier this year, for Solidarity. It will be appearing in Against the Current, and we will provide links to it. Thanks for joining us again, Brad.
Hey, my pleasure, as always.
Thank you.
our final Fred Ho composition, In a Pan-African Mood. And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Joe Clement has been our engineer. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the mole's point of view, that is, from the ground up. As moles, we seek to explore alternative possibilities for our cultural, social, and political lives that move beyond the hegemony of unfettered global capitalism and a culture of consumerism, exploitation, and environmental devastation. We agitate for a new order in which not only humanity, but other species as well can thrive and lead fulfilling lives within ecologically sustainable environments. From the mole's perspective, such effective change can only come about through grassroots democratic struggles that chip away at existing power structures in an effort to create more just and equitable communities, both locally and internationally. So tune in next Monday for more interviews and reviews, commentaries that reflect the Old Mole mission. Today's program will be podcast on the KBOO website in the next day or two. You can either listen to the entire program or specific segments. You can also find links to more information about guests and topics, as well as past programs. Just go to our webpage at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And this is KBOO, Portland 90.7 FM. Coming up at 10, Air Cascadia is off today. Instead, we'll hear an interview about a protest action this morning by Portland Rising Tide in Northwest Portland. At 10:15, we'll hear Locus Focus with guest host Stephanie Potter. Today's guest is Hank Patton, founder of World Steward, a group focused on the art and science of managing resources as if the future mattered. We'll talk about intergenerational finance and promoting sustainable business practices. Do call in with your questions and suggestions. At 11 o'clock, it's Health and Healthcare Forum with host Roberta Hall. Today's guest is David K. Johnston, author of the new book, Divided: The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. And that's our program for today. Thank you.
And it is 10 a.m. You are tuned to KBOO Portland. And as you heard, Air Cascadia is off today. Instead, we'll hear an interview about a protest action this morning by Portland Rising Tide in Northwest Portland. And we'll hear an excerpt from the series Between the Lines on a new report from Public Citizens Congress Watch titled Outside Spenders, Local Elections. And also coming up this morning, Stephanie Potter will be guest host for Locus Focus. And at 11, there's a special edition of Health and Healthcare Forum with host Roberta Hall. She interviews investigative journalist David K. Johnston about healthcare inequality. And I want to thank KBOO members for your generous support for community radio. If you are not a current member, you can become one. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate today. Now, let's listen to this before we go to our 10 a.m. program.
This single independent radio station is searching for the 10x10 pop-up of our dreams. Must love travel, the outdoors, music festivals, and live remote radio broadcasts. If you can spare the canvas structure we're craving, call us at 503-231-8732 to donate today. Run away with us to our community radio station, KBOO.
And now, local climate activists from Portland Rising